I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com, BalanceBodyLabs.com, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another edition of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I'm your host, John Hansen. And today we have a very special episode with six-time Mr. Olympia, Dorian Yates. Last week was the last episode of season one, where we talked about the 40th anniversary of the movie Pumping Iron. So now we are starting a Mr. Olympia series, and we are kicking it off today with six-time Mr. Olympia, Dorian Yates. I got a chance to talk to Dorian a couple of weeks ago at his home in Spain. So we just launched the video interview of Dorian, which was part one, and you can see that at bodybuildinglegendshow.com under our video section, but we're also releasing it for our podcast. So all of you who listen to the podcast, you'll be able to listen to the full interview on this episode. So I want to welcome some new sponsors to the show. TrueNutrition.com. Are you looking for professional quality supplementation at rock bottom prices? Well, at TrueNutrition.com, they skip the fancy marketing gimmicks and they focus on quality and value. In addition to offering the highest quality bodybuilding supplements at the lowest prices, they also offer the world's largest selection of custom protein powder blends. And all of their products are third-party verified. True Nutrition lets you create custom protein blends based on your goals, lifestyle, diet, and taste, with over 60 types of powders, flavors, and performance boosts to choose from. You're not like everyone else, and with our 18 billion possible combinations, you don't have to be. They offer the same level of customization for their delicious oatmeal blends as well, allowing you to choose oats, fruits, nuts, seeds, and more, so that your functional nutrition is never boring. So use the code Hansen, that's H-A-N-S-E-N, at the checkout for big savings this month, and join the thousands of other bodybuilders and athletes who have discovered TrueNutrition.com. I also want to welcome another sponsor, Balance Body Labs. If you're working hard to achieve your physical best, you need the optimum level of nutrients to reach peak performance. When your nutrients go missing, so does your ability to have a productive day. Balance Body Labs has an easy-to-use at-home test kit to help you detect your nutrient levels. They offer three different categories of tests, one for endurance athletes, two for those training for a contest, and three for weight loss. Just choose your level. Take the simple test at home, mail the test kit back, and then log on for your results. They will test for your vitamin levels, your amino acids, testosterone levels, cortisol levels, and your lactic acid. No more going to a doctor's office and going through a painful blood test. If you don't know what your nutrient levels are, you won't be able to perform at optimum levels. Balance Body Labs will get you there. Just log on to BalanceBodyLabs.com and sign up for the easy-to-use at-home testing kit today. And we're also brought to you by our friends at Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services to ensure that you will not only look and feel amazing, but you're also comfortable knowing they're there for you every step of the way. They offer competitive pricing along with quality products and services. And those are just a few reasons to give them a call. Use the promotion code LEGEND for a free consultation and get 20% off all packages. Go to their website at opeshealth.org. That's O-P-E-S-health.org. Or if you want to call them directly, call their office number at 813-906-6737. They are located in Tampa, Florida, but anybody in the United States can use their services. That's opishealth.org. All right. I want to thank our three sponsors for sponsoring this special edition of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, our interview with six-time Mr. Olympia, Dorian Yates. And here is that interview. Enjoy it. All right. Welcome to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my guest today is one of the real legends of the sport, Dorian Yates, six-time Mr. Olympia. And Dorian redefined the sport, not only with his size and muscularity, but also with his training intensity. And he's still regarded, I think, today as one of the best Mr. Olympias ever. Dorian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, John.
Listen, I've been watching some of your interviews lately with some mainstream people like Tim Ferriss, who did his podcast, and Brian from London Real. He did some really excellent videos. You've really done a great job articulating the sport of bodybuilding to mainstream people that aren't really in the sport, really explaining it very well.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it's kind of hard for people to understand what it's all about. They see a guy on the stage in his underwear and his muscles and veins and stuff. And probably the first thing that comes to most people's mind is the steroid thing because just because we look so freakily different, you know, and how is that possible and all this kind of stuff. So
yeah,
I try to get across to people that there's a lot more involved in the sport than that, you know, without brushing it under the carpet, so to speak.
Yeah, you're doing a great job. Well, let's talk about how you got involved in the sport of bodybuilding. I read your book, Warrior Story, with you and Peter McGuff. And I met Peter out here a few years now. He lives in Florida like I do. So I talked to him recently about the beginning of your career. And I know you were in that detention center and you were doing like a circuit training. And the guy who was the guard, he noticed your potential for bodybuilding and for physical work.
Well, I had a little bit of a background because I was 15, 16 years old at school and I was doing karate. And at the karate place, which later in my life became the Temple Gym, actually. Mm-hmm. At the time when I was young, there was two areas. There was one area for karate and kung fu, and then they had a smaller kind of area off to the side for weights. And it was all, you know, real beat up old weight gym, but, you know, some good guys in there and stuff. So I was doing karate and I noticed that and I started working out a little bit and I actually enjoyed the weights more. And me and my friend, we managed to get hold of, which was very difficult. There was only one magazine store in the whole city. The whole fucking city with 1 million people. There's only one store there that sold the muscle magazines, you know? And they were like on the top shelf next to Zipper and all these magazines, you know, like, so you had to go there and be brave enough to ask for that magazine up on the top shelf. You know?
Right.
And on the front of there, I think one of the first ones we saw had Robbie Robinson on there.
Yeah.
so I was very, you know, I was very interested then. And I saw the Pumping Iron film with Arnold in and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I left school and I left home and I was kind of like, you know, didn't have stability, was living at different places and on the street and stuff like that. So whatever thoughts I had about doing bodybuilding, they were, you know, they were gone for the time being. And a couple of years later, I got in a little trouble, nothing serious, but I was in this detention center and there have a regime which was kind of like military-like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You had like, you know, you had to have your bed all, like being in the military, you have to have your bed, the sheets all square, you had to stand to attention, you had to march everywhere, you know, trying to give these young guys discipline. That was the idea, you know?
Mm-hmm.
and so it was quite physical. One of the things we did was the circuit training. And the first day in there, like, I guess they to assess you, you know? And they had all these exercises, like freehand squats, push-ups, chin-ups, some weight stuff, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you were told to go around the circuit three times. When you've gone around three times, you sit down, you know? So I zipped around this thing three times and I sat down and the guy was like pissed off with me because he was like, I fucking told you to go around three times, you know? I was like, I did already. And he's like, let me see that again, you know? So I did zip around again. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, you probably did. And then we had actually powerlifting lessons in there.
That was really? Okay.
The guy who ever run the physical department, he fancied himself as being a powerlifter, I guess. So that's what they taught. So, you know, doing a bench squat and deadlift. And I'm sure my weights were not very impressive, but they were more than pretty much everybody else.
Yeah.
And I had somewhat of a physique. You know, I had the shape. Mm-hmm. Looking with the abdominals and everything, very lean.
Yeah.
And the guys in there were like, you should do something when you get out. You should be a power lifter. And, what you know, I was like, in my head, I was already like, no, I don't want to be a power lifter. I want to be a bodybuilder, you know?
Okay.
So I think I was in there with a lot of young guys. There was like 300. And I was better than all of them at something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this was a thing. And this was something positive, and it's the only thing I had to, like, grasp onto, you know. I didn't have a family, didn't have an education, didn't read much of anything, but this thing I was good at, so I was like, wow, that's something I'm good at, and I don't want to come back to this kind of a place again, man. You know, like, just, it doesn't matter. Even if you were living in a fucking hotel room with a TV and a nice soft bed and all this stuff, your liberty is taken away.
Yeah.
You can't, where you want to go, when you want to go, and you just got to stay in that one fucking place, and you're just a number, you know? So,
yeah.
I didn't want to have any more of that in my life. So it gave me that, you know, it gave me that push to say, hey, that thing that you liked and that you were kind of thinking, you know, mm-hmm. you could be good, you actually can be, and it's something very positive. If you put your energy into that, good things are going to happen.
Yeah.
To what extent, I didn't know, you know, I didn't know whatever, I didn't know, I wasn't really even thinking I could be Mr. Olympia, but something, man, you know, mm-hmm. so I did it, and I took some time to study about training, about nutrition, and before I even started it. So I had this plan, like, I'm going to do this fucking thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it to the maximum and see what I can do. I just know that something's good going to come from it. Who knows, man? Like, just even if it meant that I just opened a gym, that would have been something very positive and a great improvement on my prospects. So,
yeah.
You know, it turned out to be even bigger than that, obviously.
Yeah, I read that. I read that you studied the sport, and you were studying, I guess, different training methods and stuff before you actually went into a gym. Is this when you found out about Mike Mentzer's training program?
Yeah, I read a little bit about Mike Mentzer in my first, initial time when I was training when I was young, because I think he was just coming on the scene then. There was a few articles coming out, and the heavy duty courses and all that stuff. So I knew about him, and then I read Arthur Jones's books, and I read Mike's writings, and it just kind of clicked with me that I'm a logical thinker, I'm a mathematical brain kind of guy, you know, so it sounded like it fucking made sense, right? But not only that, I noticed if I did, especially in the beginning when, you know, you're natural and you work in a job and all these other things, right? If I trained more than 3 or 4 times a week, or if it did more than a certain number of sets, I just quickly just didn't get anywhere. Yeah. I just stuck, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Then I took the week off, and then I came back and I did less, and guess what? Well, I'm getting bigger and I'm getting stronger, you know? I even, at the start, you know, I was getting sick. I was getting like a throat tonsil infection or something.
Yeah.
And what I realized was that I was getting, you know, my immune system was getting run down because I was overtrained.
Right.
So not only did it make sense logically to me, in practice, it also worked.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's why I went with it, and kind of, I guess I refined it over the years, because Arthur Jones was not a competitive bodybuilder, or he didn't really understand all the aspects of competitive bodybuilding, what competitive bodybuilder's physique must look like. His advice was mainly geared to just building maximum muscle, and, you know, not perhaps working on the side delt that you need to create that illusion of width and various different exercises you need to do. So my training had more variety than Arthur Jones would recommend, and also it was split over, you know, different body parts, which he didn't initially recommend. But Mensa realized that you had to do that, you couldn't train your whole body in one workout as Arthur Jones recommended and have a complete bodybuilding physique. I mean, you know, it would be too much in one bite, so to speak. So I refined it a bit over the years,
right?
But that's where the information and the inspiration came from, from those two guys. I didn't pull it out of thin air.
Yeah. So you started bodybuilding officially then in 1983, and Peter told me that your first contest was actually like a gym contest, right, in 1984?
Yeah, it's a funny story. The pictures that are out there, some may have seen them, some pictures of me in a little pair of gray shorts, which were, they were in fashion at the time.
Yeah,
okay. All right. Yeah, so those pictures were taken by the guy that ran the gym that later became Temple Gym, and his name was Martin. And he took that, he was like a photographer, so it was good because, and it's not like now you have an iPhone with a camera on.
Yeah.
Not many people walk around with a fucking camera back in those days.
Right,
so
right.
Gym owner was also a photographer. And so he persuaded me to take some pictures, which I'm really glad that he took now, because it showed my physique after very little kind of training. And actually, when he took those photos, he's like, I'm putting on like an inter-gym contest, you know,
mm-hmm.
for the local gyms in Birmingham. And I think you should go in the first time. It's like, you know, you look great. You should really, you know, you have a good chance. And I'm like, nah, man, I don't want to compete yet. I'm not ready and stuff. But I got a cold or a flu or something. So I had a week off the gym and I wasn't eating properly and had a bit of a fever. And I don't know, I lost like, whatever, 6 or 7 pounds. And I looked in the mirror and I was like, wow, shit, I look cut, you know. It's like, maybe I'll just do that contest. Like, you know, no, there's no preparation or nothing. It was like, you know, I was young and I was very lean naturally anyway. So it was enough that I kind of dieted for a week. So I did that and I went into the contest and a couple of guys that I beat were, you know, they'd competed before and they were on the juice and all that stuff and I wasn't. And mm-hmm. I managed to win that. So again, you know, it's just more encouragement, I guess.
Yeah.
And about a year later, I did the contest that I planned to do, and that was an intermediate contest, which I guess that would be called a novice contest in the States. And I wanted to win this novice qualifier, and I wanted to win the novice British. That was like, you know, that's what I wanted to do.
That was your goal.
I always had a plan, right? So
yeah.
And that was my plan. But that plan went astray because when I went to the contest and I won the contest, like, I didn't know. When I was there, I was backstage and I was, you know, I was like, wow, this guy's good and that guy's good. And, but yeah, you know, I think I got a chance. But mm-hmm. that's all I was thinking. When I see the pictures now, I'm like, yeah, I can see what everyone saw, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone's freaking out. I came off the stage and Ron Davis was there, who was a judge at the Olympia, and he was the head of the federation in England. And he was, wow, who, you know, where have you come from? And why are you in this novice cast? I said, like, it's my first contest and come from Birmingham. I've like, been training for a year and a half, so I'm not good enough to go in the heavyweight class. And they're like, you know, kind of half laughing. They said, it's not good enough to go in the heavyweight class. Well, we got news for you, son. You're probably the best heavyweight we got in the country. And like, I didn't believe it, but they were probably right.
Yeah.
So they said, we want you to compete in the World Games, the next, which is coincidentally was the next weekend. So, I was like, nah, I don't want to do that. And, you know, they, you know, you can do it. And persuaded me to come along the next day to a selection for the British team. So I went along to the selection for the British team, and they chose me and another guy to be the heavyweight representatives at the World Games. And I went there and, you know, like feeling kind of out of place and a bit starstruck because Barry DeMay was there.
Right.
And, you know, he was like, he was all in the magazines. I knew who he was. And Matt Mendenhall, of course, he was Weider's kind of, you know, big star that they were promoting there and, you know, great physique.
Right.
Those two guys were there. But I managed to get seventh place out of 13 guys. And, like, you know, these were seasoned guys that had been competing for years and stuff. So,
right.
Although I didn't like it because I was disappointed that I wasn't able to plan for it. And that made me more determined that every contest that I did in the future would be my choice and it would be strategic and I would be in control.
Yeah.
But, you know, seventh place was not bad after, like, a year and a half training and going up against, you know, very experienced bodybuilders. So
yeah.
That's the story there. That's what happened at that contest, you know.
And people today may not know this, but the World Games was held, I think, every 4 years. Like, it was a, sort of like an Olympic qualifier, right?
I think it's basically sports that are not in the Olympics, but, you know, they're trying to get in there. So
yeah.
What it was in there, powerlifting, I mean, water skiing and various other sports were in there. So it was a whole lot of different sports at the World Games. But it was equivalent of a World Championship. So that means it was a pro qualifier, and that's how Barry DeMay qualified to be pro.
Exactly, right. Okay, so then next year in 1986, you go into the British Championships, right, or England Championships, and
yep.
You win the heavyweight class, and in kind of a controversial decision, you lose the overall to Chris Oscus, was it?
Yeah, Chris Oscus was a light heavyweight winner, and I was a heavyweight winner, and I think most people thought that I should have won the contest. Yeah, I thought I should have won it, and I didn't like it too much that he won. I thought it was a bit political because I was never have been like the guy to, you know, go shake hands and kiss ass and
right.
Just my way. I just turn up and like, if I'm good enough, I'm good enough. Like, that's it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of that reclusive guy that wasn't very sociable and, you know, so on. So I didn't kiss ass enough, I guess. I don't know. But I took it as like a blessing, really, because at that point I wouldn't be ready to be a pro or good to be a pro. So, you know, what's the point to have your pro card and you're not ready to use it, right? So no big deal. I had an injury to my hip as well that I did quite very early on, squatting. So in 1987, I kind of took the year off from competing and also opened the gym, Open Temple Gym, which gave me a source of income because, you know, I speak to Peter and another guy. I've been writing my autobiography, and I distinctly remember coming back from the British Championship, you know, and there were like busloads of people coming from the gyms in Birmingham to go watch, and, you know, you're at this contest and there's thousands of people there and the magazines and photographers, and you get all this adulation and you get your trophy. And I go home to my one bedroom apartment that doesn't really have any furniture in there and no car. And, you know, I'm British champion, but there's no fucking newspapers or TV outside my apartment on this council estate, which is, I guess, that's what you call projects or government housing in the US, you know. So that's where I was. I was British champion, but I didn't have two pennies to rub together. I was still working security on bars and nightclubs just to make enough money to train and all that stuff. But fortunately, because I won the British Championship, then somebody was willing to back me with the gym, with the money to get the equipment and like do a profit share kind of thing and everything. So, so 87 was like setting that up, setting the gym up, and setting myself so I have some stability and source of income. So now I can really train to be a pro without, like, you know, distractions of being up late at night working on doors and all this kind of stuff. So.
Yeah.
87, I got the gym, and 88, I came back to the British Championship and, like, made sure there was no mistakes the second time, you know?
What did they do with that surgery, Dorian? I forgot about that. You had hip surgery in 87.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, we all thought we were Tom Platz back in the day.
Right.
You know, I had my flat-soled powerlifting shoes, I had my knee wraps, and I was doing squats. Like, I mean, we didn't have a lot of equipment in the first gym I trained at anyway, so... It was, you know, it was like everyone was squatting, and if you didn't squat, you were not even a real fucking man. Like, fuck up out of the gym, you know?
Yeah.
That was the attitude. And if you want a great legs, you got to do squats, because that's what everybody says. And Tom Platz is like, you know, way ahead of everybody else. And he said, you got to squat. So, you know, that's what we did. And I used to squat, like, you know, ass to heels. And I think my structure didn't like it, because one day something tore around the hip. I think it was the fascia over the hip.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, you know, I didn't know squat. I'm like, we have no sports medicine doctors in England in the 80s. And, you know, you know, if you go to your doctor, your MD, or, you know, hey, I heard, well, you know, why are you being stupid and lifting those weights? Stop doing that. Yeah, and take these anti-inflammatories and painkillers and, like, you know.
Yeah.
That's it. So I just waited until it felt like it was a bit better, and I started training again, and it popped again because it had scar tissue in there and it wasn't healed properly. And so it became a little bit of a recurring problem. So they surgically removed a piece of scar tissue, and I was then forced to look at alternatives to free weight squats because, you know, the risk. And, you know, if you're injured, you can't train at all. So even if it's a compromise, like, you know, there's a balance some way. Okay, squats might be great, but the risk benefit. So let me try something else. So I started squatting on a Smith machine and doing leg press and, you know, pre-exhausting with leg extensions. And, you know, my legs improved. So you definitely can do it without squats. If I hadn't got injured, maybe I'd have carried on doing squats and my legs would have been just as good, or maybe they've been better. Nobody knows.
Yeah.
You know, need another Dorian for that. But, you know, I don't think they're necessarily the best thing for everybody.
Didn't you meet Tom at a seminar when you were younger, when you first started bodybuilding?
I do believe I met Tom. I mean, in the 80s, seminars were really big in the UK.
Yeah.
And Ron Davis, who was, you know, he had the connection because he used to go to the States to judge at Olympia and all, he knew all the guys. So he used to bring them over. And pretty much every month at one point, we did have somebody coming over. So I saw Tom, I saw Robbie Robinson, I saw Victor Richards, Lance Dreyer, right. Tim Belt, Bertle Fox, Mike Christian, Lee Haney.
Wow.
It was a cool time because, you know, there was no internet, right? So the only way to information is through the magazines or, wow, this guy's coming to town and you're going to see him in the flesh, man. He's real and you're going to see it, what he really looks like, because you've only seen photos and videos up to this point. So seminars were massive, man. They were sold out. I mean, they don't work now just because, you know, you got access at the click of a finger. You can see everything about everybody. So there's less appeal of seeing and not only seeing, listening to the guy in person about his training and all these kind of things.
Yeah, so, exactly. Hearing it from the horse's mouth.
to be coming up as a fan in UK in the 80s, I think.
Yeah. So 88, then you go to the British Championships again, and you were obviously much improved, and you wiped everybody out. You won the heavyweight and overall quite easily, I believe.
Yeah, that was very clear. When there was no competition at all, really, and that's when people started saying, "Hey, this guy, you know,
he could
be a good pro." I don't know if anyone was saying at that point he could be Mr. Olympia. Well, probably a few people were, but it was definitely like, "Wow, this guy's, you know, he can do something."
So. Yeah. Peter told me that I think that contest was about a week after the '88 Olympia, which he saw in Los Angeles, and when he saw you win the British Championships, he told you you could have been in the top six at the '88 Olympia.
Yeah, Peter was very encouraging, and I trusted him, and he did know. I mean, I don't really know anybody in bodybuilding who knows more about bodybuilding and the history of bodybuilding than Peter. So, you know, I had Peter telling me this, and I had Ron Davis, also, who was a judge at the Mr. Olympia, telling me basically the same thing. I'm not really sure if I believed them 100% at that point. Still needed, you know? I needed to be standing next to these guys, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the chance I had to do that was Night of Champions. That was my first pro show. Peter was very positive. Ron Davis was very positive. But I don't feel like the general vibe was very positive. The general vibe and opinion of people was this. Yes, you're good, but you can't beat the Americans because they have all the publicity. Hmm. Yeah, the publicity in the magazines is, you know, it makes a difference.
Yeah.
You don't know the judges. Yeah, you don't have any relationship with the judges. You don't know the judges. That's not going to help you. And you're from England.
Yeah.
So all these things are going to go against you. Yeah. And I said, well, honestly, I'm just going to say that's bullshit. Yeah. Because I think if you're good enough, you're good enough. And these just seem like excuses that I've heard from people in the past. You know, I didn't place well because of this or that, or standing in the fucking shadows at the end of the stage and I didn't get noticed or whatever. It's just, hey, man, if you're good enough, it doesn't matter if you're standing in the shadows.
Right.
You know, so I'm like, I got to just be that guy, you know?
Yeah.
I got to play that and I got to be that. Because if I'm like kind of okay, I could get overlooked. So, you know, that's why I took some time out from that British Championship. I think was like more than 18 months to give everything I had to this first pro show. And I was running the gym, you know, and there weren't so many gyms around then in the 80s. So the gym was, you know, it was okay. It was giving me a decent living, you know. I had a nice place to live now. I had a car and all that stuff. And so I said, look, you know, I'm living here like a monk, yeah, and I've done this and we've got this far. And now it's like crunch time, yeah, because either I'm good enough to be a pro or I'm not. And I see so many people wasting their life and neglecting their family and other opportunities and all this stuff because they're living this dream and they think there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but there's not, you know, and there never was and never is going to be.
Right.
And I don't want to be that guy either. So, you know, I had a family, I had a son, had a wife, and, you know, they make sacrifices because of your lifestyle and everything. So, got to be justified. So I said, to justify continue doing this and living this lifestyle and giving it everything I've got, I got a place in the top five of this first pro show. If I can't, then it's really telling me I don't have what it takes to be to be one of the best, to be really up there, to be in the Mr. Olympia and you know, to be earning good living from all this, which is, you know, in the end, it's got to be some payback.
So
if I don't place in the top five, I'm not going to compete again. I didn't mean, hey, I'm not going to lift weights or nothing. Yeah, of course, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to train for myself. I'll probably open more gyms, and I wouldn't take steroids because I'm only taking them to compete, and that's the way I always approached it. So here's time to find out whether this is all worth it and whether I got what it takes. So that was really the night champions, you know, make or break. And, you know, history shows I was second and pretty close second, even though I was standing on the end in the shadows. But at the other end of the stage, because there was, I don't know, it was like nearly 30 guys in the show or something. I was at one end in the shadows. Mohamed Benaziz in the other end in the shadows, which I thought was kind of amusing because I had that border or standing in the shadows, so I didn't get a fair deal. So screw that, man. If you're good enough, they're going to see you.
Right.
You know?
Now, 1990, that was the year they drug tested the Arnold Classic and the Olympia. Did you think they were going to drug test the Night of the Champions also as you were getting ready for that?
No. If they had drug tested it, I wouldn't have gone in it because I don't know how to prepare for a contest naturally at that point. So, you know, that's what most people chose not to do. And same thing with the World Championships. And the guys that did get tested at the Olympia, you know, I mean, you know, look, let's look at the pictures, and that's why it didn't happen again.
Yeah, exactly.
The physiques, you know, the physiques were down because they do make a difference. You know, anyone that says they don't is, you know, I'm not being honest, right? So, so I won. I got second in that Night of Champions, but even though I got second, I think I made the most impact, and I was the one that got flown out to you know, to Venice Beach and Gold's Gym and all that stuff, which was huge for me. I mean, you know, I'd never been really traveling that much. Mm-hmm. I hadn't been to the States before, and boom, first of all, I'm in New York, which is like, I thought I was in a movie or something because literally I've seen New York in all the cop shows and, you know, on TV in England, they had all the American cop shows and Kojak and all this stuff. So I was like, this is surreal. This is just like, you know, I've seen this on the TV only, like in my mind, you know?
Right.
So that, and then I got flown out by Joe Weider out to Venice Beach and to do a shoot in Gold's Gym, which is every bodybuilder's dream, and this just all come from this contest. So even though I got second, I don't think it really mattered if I got first or second at that one. It was, the impact was made, and the fact that I had a unique persona on stage and stuff right from the get go, that was obvious. It was more martial and maybe more kind of aggressive and not very artistic and posy. Like, it was something different, and people are interested in that. They're bought into it.
How did the New York crowd take to you? Because you had to be pretty much an unknown by then.
That's a story, man. Because, you know, I must read every single book or every single magazine that's been published on bodybuilding from the day I started. And previous to that, because people would give me stuff. You know, guys from the gym, they know I'm a freak. I like to read stuff. And they're like, hey, I got these old Ironmans from like 1968. And, you know, the little Ironmans were like full of interesting information. So, I had this at my fingertips. Anyway, the New York crowd, I read about them. They're notoriously vocal. And like, if they're going to tell you if they like you or if they don't like you or whatever.
Right.
You know, pretty loud and raucous, like, you know, it's New York, what do you expect? So I was a little bit like, you know, wow, I don't know what to expect here. And I was a total unknown, so it took a little time for the word to go around the auditorium at the pre-judging, I guess. Like, who the fuck is this guy with the or whatever, like, you know. And then it started. Dorian.
Really?
I'm like, fuck, man. Not only that, when I was posing, I had a Robbie Robinson who was in the contest, who was like, you know, he's a fucking hero of mine.
Yeah.
He's the first guy I saw in a muscle, Joe Weider's muscle builder, you know?
Right.
And I heard this voice. Yeah, Dorian. Come on, Dorian. That's it. Squeeze. You know? And it's fucking Robbie Robinson. You know, this, and I didn't even go up and shake his hand and speak to him because I was too nervous, you know, like,
yeah.
oh, you know, I can't even say anything. And this guy was saying, you know, come on. So, again, no emails, no internet. After the show, I wrote him a letter to say, like, how much I appreciated it, because he was an idol of mine. And, yeah, you know, me and guys at school, we fucking bought the magazine with him on there. So he's a major influence. And he told me, I'm sure he don't carry it around now, but he told me he was carrying it around for a long time because it was just, you know, that touched him.
Yeah.
So that's a cool story, man. You know,
yeah,
you get
to, cool. I never heard that.
You know, somebody that was like, you know, the other side of the world in a magazine. That's, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, this was great. I got second in the contest, get out to do the shoot in Venice with Chris Lund. And I remember Chris trying to get me to wear sunglasses and spray this water on and all this shit. And I'm like, Chris, I can't do that, man. I don't do that.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, yeah, but it's what they want. I'm like, yeah, but listen, how about this? How about I lift this fucking 200-pound dumbbell? You can lift that? I'm like, yeah, I can lift it, mate. I can do a one-arm row with it. I can't hold it there for 10 seconds and fucking smile like I'm having a good time, but right, I'll get it up there, man, if you right, get the picture, you know? So boom, I got the 200-pound dumbbell up there, a couple of reps, and he got the shots, and it was, you know, I think that was the start of Chris and the magazines really doing that, because before that, it was all posed with the sunglasses, with the spray.
Right.
You know, they're very concerned about the lighting and the quality of the photo. But what about the image, the energy of the photo? You know, you want to be inspired. I used to see pictures of Tom Platz in Bob Kennedy's books that he put out. And yeah, Tom Platz, he had a full sweatsuit on.
Yeah.
But I could see the action. I could see his face. I could see the sweat. And that inspired me more than these pose
right,
pictures. I'm like, listen, I don't come from California, man. I don't hang out on the beach. I don't wear sunglasses.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's not me, and I don't feel good doing it. So let's do this. And that was my first Flex cover.
Wow. So Ben Aziza had to make an impact on you too, right? Because you said his back development was like 3D, and absolutely, that's what really made you step up your back training.
Yeah, it was super thick, like coming out 3D, especially on the lower lats, you know?
Yeah.
So that made me focus on that area, trying to thicken up that area, and that's when I really got in more into the rows, reverse yeah, grip rows, and so on, and trying to really focus on bringing the upper arm down and back and squeezing and focus into that area.
Yeah.
And, you know, improved. And then the next year I did Night Champions and, of course, the first Mr. Olympia. And then I, you know, I saw Lee Haney's back and I was like, shit, still, you know, still more thickness right, there. So, you know, there were two guys there that kind of pushed me to improve in that area.
Yeah. So the next year you did the Night of the Champions again, and this time you win. You take first place, and I believe your body weight was up about another 5 pounds, right, at that contest?
Yeah, it was fuller and heavier. I over-dieted anyway a little bit for the first one just because I was so gung-ho, you know.
Yeah.
I wanted to do well, and I wanted to be super shredded. And I made that mistake probably consistently.
Yeah.
A little bit all the time, you know, a little overdo it.
Right.
Because especially when I was like always one of the bigger guys, I didn't want to just be the bigger guy. I wanted to be like competing on condition as well with everybody, even if they were smaller.
Yeah.
So to get that combination of size and condition, sometimes I hit it. Sometimes I overdid it a little bit with losing weight, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember, I think there was an article in Flex magazine right after you won that 91 Night of the Champions, and they had comparison photos from 1990 to 91, and I think that's when I became a big fan of yours, because I was like, wow, you could tell this guy works hard because he made incredible progress in 1 year, you know?
Yeah, well, man, you know, this was my dream, and I got the validation by the trip to California, and like, man,
yeah,
you made it now, and so next year I want to win that contest. You know, Night of Champions, that was unresolved because the first time I got second. So I want to win that contest, and I want to go to Olympia, and, you know, that's what happened.
Yeah. So let's talk about that first Olympia in 1991 in Orlando, Florida. And this was Lee Haney's last Mr. Olympia. So you're obviously a big fan of Lee's growing up in the sport because he dominated bodybuilding in the 1980s. So
I started training properly in 83. Here's Mr. Olympia in 84 in New York. And
yeah,
like with a physique size really that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, he was the man the whole way through it. And I went to see him at seminar in the UK and the posing and stuff. But I realized I had to change my mindset to compete. You know, mm-hmm. you can't beat somebody if you're going to put them on a pedestal.
Yeah,
you're defeating yourself. So I had to change the mindset from being this fan to being, okay, you're great, but you're a man. You know, you got two arms, two legs, you lift weights. I do the same.
Yeah,
and I know. Absolutely, I know that you don't train harder than me. So why should I not be able to beat you?
Yeah,
and that was the mindset that I went there with. Not in any way arrogant or any way thinking it's going to be easy, but I wasn't going there with like, oh, there's no way I can win. I'm just going to go. I hope I can get second. Yeah. I didn't go. I went there to try to win.
Yeah,
didn't work out like that, but that's, you know, that was my intention and that was my mindset.
But you did beat him in the second round, the muscularity round, and I think that's the first time Lee's ever been outpointed, really, right?
I mean, I guess if the contest was judged now, I'd win, right? Because that's what it is now.
Yeah.
See, right? The seven basic poses.
Yeah.
And I don't think the posing round is scored now.
No. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why it's so fucking terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Nobody has to make any effort.
Right,
you know.
Right.
So it was good that it was scored. Although my argument was it should never, you know, the guy with the best physique should basically win.
Yeah.
But closing round is maybe if something was close, physique wise, then you could use the closing round to, you know, to make that decision.
Yeah.
If two guys are really close, I can't really decide here. But one guy's routine is sloppy and it doesn't present his physique to his advantage, and the other guy is much better. Then you have something that could make that decision.
Right.
But I didn't agree, like, it should be a round that's judged on your opposing ability, period. Because then, you know, I was like, well, Michael Jackson could come then and win that round.
right.
So why should he can't win the round? So,
yeah.
You know, that was my, you know, few people were like, oh, we should have win the posing round because we're better posers than Yates. Well, maybe you were, but your physique wasn't better, so that's what I win, you know.
So what was your thoughts after that 91 Olympia, Dorian? Because you had to feel great. You beat Vince Taylor, you beat Sean Ray, you beat Lee Labrada, you beat all these established pros. And
The thing was, I knew there was more juice left in the orange.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I knew I had it maxed out. I was still, you know, I was 29 years old when I got second to Haney. So I was fairly young, mm-hmm. and I hadn't been training as long as most of the guys, and I just felt that I had more that I could give. So I wasn't at 100%. Lee Haney was at 100%. That year was absolutely the best shape that he ever presented in his whole 8 Mr. Olympias, right? And I think the fact that he did know that somebody was coming along that was of his stature, same height, same weight, and he was hearing the rumors, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably pushed him to do a bit more than he usually would, because let's be honest, there were some girls there, but nobody that compete with Haney on his height and size advantage.
Right.
You know, you had Lee Labrada. I mean, you could argue maybe perhaps that Lee Labrada had a more complete physique than Lee Haney,
mm-hmm.
but he was much smaller, so he didn't have that impact.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, hey, I gave this guy a run. At his very best, and I'm not there yet, so I felt confident that if he did compete the next year that I would be able to beat him.
So now going into 92, Vince Taylor wins the Arnold Classic that year.
Yeah.
So I had read that you said you really didn't want to focus too much on being too big because you felt most of your competition was going to come from the smaller guys like Vince Taylor and Sean Ray and Lee Labrada.
That's correct. Because everybody wants to know what I did in 1993 to be so much bigger than 1992. But if they had seen me in the off-season in 1992, it wasn't a hell of a lot far behind how I started in 93.
Right.
It's just that I was extreme and you know, what I did, I took pictures every week so I could analyze it afterwards.
Yeah.
Then for the 92 Mr. Olympia, about 5 weeks out, man, I was good. I was too good to step on stage five weeks out.
Wow.
You know? But I was bigger and fuller, much bigger and fuller.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to get harder. So I went down. Did it get harder? Maybe a little bit. But I got a lot flatter and a lot smaller. And I was like, right. So I've analyzed that mistake. I don't make that mistake next time.
Yeah.
So I came into Mr. Olympia next year 17 pounds heavier than the previous year, which is unheard of. And it's like everyone was like, which kind of secret growth hormone do you have and what's going on in England?
Yeah.
All stuff. But I started dieting for the 1993 contest around 5 or 6 pounds heavier than the previous year. So mm-hmm. I had a very good off season, no injuries, made good progress, put on about 5 or 6 pounds, which at that point I was very happy with. But so I got 5 or 6 pounds extra, but there's like 10 or 12 pounds from the previous year that I'm now not going to sacrifice.
Yeah.
So that's where the huge gain came from. Still, people don't want to hear that, but that's, you know, that's what it is. That's the truth.
Right.
That's what happened.
So let's talk about 92 when you won. That was held in Finland, I believe, and you beat out Sean Ray, you beat out Kevin Lavroni, who was the new guy.
Yeah.
You beat out Vince Taylor, Lee Labrada. So how did that feel, finally winning the Olympia? That had to be an unbelievable moment for you, huh?
Yeah, unbelievable. Hard to describe, man. It's like surreal. You know, you start as a kid picking up these magazines and idolizing these guys, and Mr. Olympia's the pinnacle, like one guy on the planet every year.
Yeah.
And you're that guy, you know? I actually struggled a little bit with it mentally coming into the contest because I knew that I was favorite, you know?
Yeah.
Which... it's kind of an unusual position for me to be in.
You'd rather be the underdog.
Yeah, and the underdog is like, I'm used to that position, and it made me more, you know, I'll fucking show you kind of thing, you know? But I didn't have that this time. And so, wow. So really, I'm going to be the guy. I'm going to be the Mr. Olympia. And I saw, you know, like, then I, you know, talked back to myself, well, why fucking not, man? Why not you? Nobody's working harder than you, and you know, deserve it, and so why not? Like, because it's such a, you know, there's only one on the planet. That's, it's a heavy thought to have, you know?
Yeah.
But I got over that coming into the contest, and I did know that Lee was not competing, so Kevin Leverone was totally out of the blue, really. I didn't even think about him, because I know he won the Night of Champions, but... I didn't figure on him being, you know, in second place.
Yeah.
Going into the contest. I thought Sean and obviously Vince Taylor because he was second the year before and I knew Lee Labrada was there. So I said, look, I got all these guys on sides like all day long, right? So probably doesn't matter if I lose a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
But it was too much. I matched them on condition and Kevin came in looking really good. Which was a bit of a surprise for everybody, I think.
Yeah.
But he was still a bit narrow in the torso and stuff, so, you know, it wasn't too close, I don't think, that one.
Right. And Vince Taylor, you probably thought he was going to be one of your main guys because he was third to your second the year before, but he had that injury where the strap came down and hit his eye. And I read this, I don't know if this was really you or not, but... I heard that you said that he was sort of using that as an excuse for why he took sixth, and you said something like, you could have chopped my right hand off before that contest, and I still would have won.
Exactly, man. You know, you're on the coach. Something hits you in the eye, your eye hurts. Like, big deal.
Right.
How does that affect your physique? Your eye hurts, man. Uh-huh. Right, you know? So I think the guy wasn't in shape. Maybe he got hit in the eye with something, and that was just like his way out of saying, you know, this is why I don't look good. Right. After giving it quite a bit of verbal through the year, you know?
Yeah.
which, you know, smart guys know that all this verbal shit can just backfire on you as well as motivating your opponents. Mm-hmm. So the smart guys generally keep their mouth shut, you know, and just do the work.
Yeah. And that's what was different about you, Dorian, was, you know, after you won the contest, even when you won it in 92, you went back to England, you went back to your small gym, the Dungeon Gym, and you got to work. And you didn't say much. You were quiet. You didn't trash talk with anybody. And I think that's why Peter called you the shadow, right?
Yeah, because I used to do that and disappear. And I felt comfortable doing that, and I did have a very good instinct for psychology.
Yeah.
For like sports psychology, a very, very good instinct for that. And I knew that if people could see me every day, if I train at Gold's Gym and they could see me every day, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. So, you know, if you see somebody every day, they become more, I don't know, more human. But if you've got this guy the other side of the world that you can only hear rumors about, you know, it's more of a, you know, more of a cloud in your mind, this guy. What's he up to? What's he doing? I don't know. I can't see him. I can't get a grip on this guy, like, mentally, you know?
Right.
So there was that. And also the fact that I knew if I was in the States and I was signed to Weider Company, Joe pretty figured me out pretty quickly. He's just like, this guy, you just got to let him do what he wants to do. And, you know, you're not going to get him to do anything you don't want him to do. He doesn't want to do. He tried for like 1 hour to get me to smile for a picture. I could do it now, no problem, because I feel comfortable doing it. But I didn't then. And it's just, doesn't matter what you tell me, I just can't do it. I can't do it smile. So I got one Muscle and Fitness cover with a female model maybe a corner of my lips to turn off. So that's why I think Joe decided this guy is just for a flex, for hardcore.
Right.
No. So I was working for the Weider Company, but because I was in England, basically, they couldn't hassle me too much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that. I just wanted to be like when I was an amateur, you know? Yeah. I just wanted to train. I wanted to eat. I wanted to sleep. I wanted to, you know, keep my regime that had got me to be the best in the world. I didn't want it to be disrupted with, you know, people pulling on me left, pulling on me right. And, you know, there's a lot of hot girls there and there's parties and, you know, there's a whole social scene and very easy to, you know, to slip into some of that and lose your eye of the tiger, you know, like in a Rocky movie, right? He got comfortable. He got his mansion, you know, and he got this guy, this animal that's hungry now chasing him. So I just wanted to be, continue to be the animal, you know?
Yeah.
Even though I was a professional bodybuilder, I wanted to be really like an amateur, you know?
Yeah.
The money was, so, you know, I like the money bit about the professional, but,
right,
you know, I wanted to select when and where I was going to travel so I could control everything. I could know when I'm going to do it and, how, you know, where I'm going to train and all that stuff. So I wanted to have control on my destiny all the time. And I thought if I was in the States, that would be something I would lose inevitably. You know, I'm there, people can call on me. So
it
was a few reasons why I took that stance, you know, staying outside of the country.
Right. And then some people were saying that you were going to be like just a one-time Mr. Olympia too, right? And didn't that sort of motivate you for 93?
The first time, because the contest was held in Finland, that means some people were probably not there from the States that would normally be there, so
right.
There was that. And it was held in Finland, and I'm European. I've never been to Finland before, by the way. I don't speak the language. I speak the same language as American, but, you know, there was that thing that I'm European, it's in Europe, and Lee Haney's retired, so this guy's won. But next year, you know, surely LeBron or Flex Wheeler, who's just coming up, you know, one of the Americans will win it, because I was the first European to win it. So I think there was that, and I'm like, you haven't got it right, guys. You don't not understand yet, you know?
Yeah.
You will understand next time, you know? It'll be more outright next time. So
Wasn't it true you hung up the poster of the 93 Olympia in your gym, and you said you can kiss my ass or something?
Well, the first time I won the Mr. Olympia 92, there was a picture of lap spread with the medal and the trophy and everything.
Uh-huh.
Because you know how it is, wherever you're from, man, it's like people are not going to appreciate you, or they think just because somebody's from somewhere else, they must be better, or, you know, or maybe they're jealous. They don't want to, like, you know, they don't want to see somebody from the same circumstances as them being successful, because then they have to reflect on their lack of achievement. And there's a lot of reasons, man, but there's always people that, you know, saying you can't do it. So I always use that as motivation. So it was like, you know, to all the non-believers, now you can kiss my ass. And that was on the wall of the gym.
One thing I forgot to ask you about 92 also was the return of Lou Ferrigno. Were you thinking about him at all as you were getting ready for the show?
Not really. I know Joe really wanted to win.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike, you know, people think that Joe Weider had some kind of influence on the Mr. Olympia contest. I don't know about the past before I was there, because I wasn't there.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, at least in the period of the 90s and so on, Joe Weider had absolutely zero influence on the contest. There are other people running it, other people judging it.
Right.
And so he's just a figurehead. Well, he would have liked Lou, because Lou would be, you know, hugely marketable.
Yeah.
And so Joe was kind of pushing Lou to win. And there was some interviews in the magazine beforehand, you know, what interviewing all the Mr. Olympia contest competitors, what do they think about, you know, Lou Ferrigno coming back and everything. I don't remember exactly what I said, but I said, you know, for me, it's not an issue.
Yeah.
And he's probably going to realize that this is not a movie, it's not TV, it's real, you know? Right. So, yeah, Lou looked great, though. I mean, he looked better than, like, back in the 70s and stuff. So,
yeah, he was big.
You know, he kept up with the times, with the training and the diet and everything. But I think it was, like, 12th or 13th place.
Yeah.
That was a good comeback for him, but the sport had moved on, and the standard of the physique's obviously much higher than when he competed. So even though he took a stride forward, it wasn't enough to, you know, to catch the guys in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. So then 93, like you said, that was your big improvement. You were like 15 or 17 pounds heavier. And
yeah.
What were you thinking about Flex Wheeler? Because he had won the Arnold that year, and he had a lot of hype. Because as the new pro with the great aesthetics.
Yeah. Well, I really like Flex physique, the balance and the muscle shapes and everything like that. But I kind of thought the outcome would be what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would overpower him with size and density. You know, a lot of people that look at pictures and videos, there's something about my physique that probably doesn't show up very well there. You have to see it live.
Yeah.
And that's not just the volume of the muscle. You know, you can have volume, but it's the density of the muscle. So even if someone was the same size next to me, they didn't look as impressive because they didn't have that certain look of density which came from consistently training very heavy.
Yeah.
So I thought I would beat Flex on size and density. And I thought that I would definitely beat him on conditioning as well.
Yeah.
Although at the Arnold Classic, his conditioning was very good. but I got to know Flex a little bit. I knew he was quite emotional, not very, I don't know if balance is the right word, probably not the right word, but, you know.
Focused.
Focused, and, you know, he had a lot of things distract him and so on. So I felt they'd probably have a hard time duplicating that Arnold condition for the Olympia, because it's only, you know, 6 months later. It's quite a tricky time period.
Yeah.
And he was on the road and stuff like that. So, and I'd made such improvements that, you know, I just felt like really confident going into the contest. Like, nobody can touch this, you know. I knew that from when I guest posed in New York for Steve and Bev Francis at the show there. I think it was 7 weeks out or 8 weeks out.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody just freaked, you know. They'd never seen anything like it. So, and, you know, people were there, that judges and so on. So it was good opinions that everyone was like, this is, you know, no one can touch this now.
I think those pictures, too, in Flex Magazine, which I think was the December issue, but it came out before the Olympia, I think that freaked everybody out when they saw those pictures of the gym.
It freaked everybody out, and it wasn't my intention. It wasn't even my intention that those photos would be published.
Yeah.
It's just that I had a set of photos taken in the gym the year before, and I asked Kevin to come down and take the same photos in the same place in the gym, so I had some professional photographs in order to compare two conditions. A little bit misleading, because the 92 photos are taken after the contest.
Oh, okay.
When I've lost size and I've smoothed out a little bit after a few days.
Yeah.
So if I had photos that were taken 7 or 8 weeks before the 92 and compared them to the black and white ones from 93,
right,
it'd be a huge difference, yeah?
Yeah.
But it was very dramatic, because one was kind of depleted and one was like middle of the contest prep, so it was still very full and everything.
Yeah.
So it was just for me. Which explains where I'm wearing my underwear and my socks.
Yeah.
Because they weren't meant for a magazine. But Kevin Horton, that took the pictures, sent copies to Peter McGough, and Peter McGough was working at Flex, so Peter got them in the magazine. But before he put them in the magazine, he had them in his drawer, in his desk.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, everybody used to visit the office, Flex, Sean, Paul DeLette,
yeah,
Chris Cormier, all these guys up to the office just to hang out and bullshit and stuff. So he said, you know, when the guys came in, I'd very casually, you know, he said, first of all, he said I'd wait because I knew they'd ask about you because right. They know we're friends. So they're going to ask about you, right? So he'll just wait. Oh, how's Darren doing? How's he going training? Oh, yeah, he's good. Yeah, his training's going really well. Actually, I got some recent pictures if you'd like to look. So they're like, yeah, yeah. And then, boom, they'd land on the table and their face would go. Yeah, I think everybody was like kind of competing for second in their mind.
Yeah.
By the time we got there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought you looked incredible in 93. I don't think there was any contest with anyone else, you know, at all.
No, that was, I mean, clear. I think I didn't even get a call out.
Yeah.
The second round.
Yeah.
So people said, how do you feel? You didn't even get a call out. I said, how did I feel? I said, I felt like I'm either dead last or I'm definitely first. So I'm not fucking last, am I? So I said, I don't mind. You know, I did the hard work all year round, so I don't mind. I have to work hard on stage. It's okay. You know?
Yeah. So let's talk about 94 now, because that was different. You were really put to the test.
Absolutely.
I think you had a rotator cuff injury earlier in the year, right? And then a leg injury, and then, of course, the bicep.
Yeah. You know, I remember Steve Weinberg, because I used to train with Steve, you know?
Mm-hmm.
After I won the 93 contest, and Steve said in his, you know, very New York way that, you know, just stop this fucking heavy training now, man. Like, you know, just hold it and chisel. And I like, actually, it was good advice, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't want to. That's what got me there, and I wanted to continue doing it. And I wanted to push and see if I could do more, man. Like, why stop now, you know? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I started to get a little couple of injuries. And once you got one or two, unless you really back off and deal with them over a period of time,
mm-hmm.
it's like your body's a piece of chain, you know?
Yeah.
Now you've got a link that's damaged somewhere, and it just like fucking goes down the chain. You see it often with bodybuilders. They get one injury, and then they just like, you know, boom, 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 they start getting various injuries.
Right.
So I think from all the heavy pressing that I did, especially I used to do the heavy pressing on a Smith machine, which I know now is not really a good idea because you're forcing your joints through an unnatural plane of movement with heavy weights. So I did a lot of incline presses on the Smith machine just because my upper chest was weak and that was like really isolated and worked for me.
Yeah.
But over a period of time, I think it was damaging my rotator cuff. And that was causing my shoulder to slightly rotate forward.
Mm.
And I was doing the undergrip rows, which means you got to supinate. And I noticed when I was grabbing the bar, the left was kind of awkward to get my left hand on there. So that was putting extra tension on the bicep, I guess. And
so the bicep and the shoulder were the same arm then, huh?
The same arm. The bicep, tricep, and shoulder is all on one arm.
Wow.
I guess I can trace it all back to the shoulder.
Yeah.
That's what I believe. You know, it all starts in one place. And even the shoulder, with what I know now, can be traced right back down the line to the opposite hip.
Oh, no kidding.
The opposite hip is connected to the shoulder. So I just learned that recently from somebody I've been working with. So, you know, 10 years later from the squat injury, I get a shoulder injury, and it's all kind of related.
Yeah.
Although, you know, let's be fair, it wouldn't happen unless I'm putting my body under extreme stress.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm saying I'm doing reverse bent over rows, I was rowing 440 6 weeks out from Mr. Olympia.
Wow.
You know, now I know it wasn't necessary. I could have been throwing 300 or 350 and just squeezing it and
concentrating
on maintaining at that point because I had the size.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so what's the point to train with those super heavy weights which you need to build size when you've already got the size and now you don't have even sufficient calories to build anything anyway? So
right. You
just shift your weight training to maintenance.
Yeah.
Unless you use diet and some increased cardio activity to lose the fat and the weight. And
right.
Just concentrate on maintaining. you know, which is what they used to do back in the old day, I guess, Arnold and those guys, they trained pretty light, just fast in a lot of sets just to burn.
Right.
Because they already built the size in off-season.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was, you know, people say, well, you know, do you still, like, stand by your training system because you got injured? I'm like, absolutely. If you want to build muscle mass, it's the quickest, most efficient system you can have. What was my application of it?
Yeah.
Trying to do kind of training in a contest phase when I was tired and I was probably slightly dehydrated and I didn't have a lot of body fat and I wasn't sleeping properly and yeah. All those things that you get coming into a contest. And maintaining, you don't need, maintaining is quite easy. I see people do it all the time when I go to the gym.
Yeah.
Every time you go in the gym, that guy's maintaining. You go back and it'll look exactly the same.
Right? I see that too. So what were your thoughts, Dorian, when you did tear that bicep? And I saw the pictures where it was all black and blue. I mean, did you think that was it? You were out that year?
Absolutely. Like, I fucking did this, you know, to the max. I've dedicated my life to this. I've lived like a monk.
Yeah.
Sacrificed a lot to do this. And now I got there. Not only have I got there, I've got there and, like, better than anyone ever, basically, and clearest winner ever. Got, you know, wow, you can win 6, 8, whatever you want now, yeah?
Yeah.
And now it looks like my whole career is over in one moment.
Yeah.
And, man, I was sick to my stomach, not only from the physical pain, but from the emotional pain. The realization of it, the fucking situation, you know? So it was like that for really, you know, until my positivity kicked in. I was like, hold on, listen. Let's see what we can do here before we throw the towel in and like decide not to compete and just go eat a bunch of pizzas and drink beer and like cry yourself to sleep.
Yeah.
Before you do that and it's all over, why don't you see what you can do? Because it's 6 weeks before the contest. Maybe somehow you can heal the injury. Maybe, you know, you can train, but you might have to train around it and you can keep doing the diet and you're in good shape. So you can always throw the towel in 2 days before the contest if you want. If you're like, fuck, man, look, I tried, but not good enough, and I can't do it, and that's it. But if I didn't try, there will always be that voice of that. What about if you fucking tried, man? Maybe you could have done it. So I wasn't really confident that I was going to do the contest until probably like a couple of weeks out.
Wow.
You know? And I was still a little bit bruised, and obviously the bicep was, you know, it tore. I hadn't detached the tendon or anything, but it tore the belly of the muscle. So now it's much shorter.
Okay.
And the question is, like, how visible is that? How is it going to affect you? Front double bicep, you know, you're screwed, right?
Yeah.
You know, that pose is fucked now.
Right.
But actually, it's not visible in any of the other poses.
Right.
So it's not visible in any of the quarter turns. It's not visible in any of the 6 compulsory poses. So you're going to lose the double bicep to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Worst case scenario, you lose to everybody in the contest, double bicep.
Yeah.
But what about the other poses? If I'm in shape, I know there's some poses I cannot be beaten on. You know? Certainly front lat spread, back lat spread. And also side tricep, very difficult because I don't have the best triceps, but if you look at the thing as a whole,
with
the cuffs and the hamstrings and the intercostals, everything, it's a hard one to beat. Also, flex was not there because flex had been in a car accident.
Yeah, that's right.
So, and was Kevin there? I can't even remember.
Yeah, Kevin took, I think, 4th.
Okay,
no, so
Kevin was probably a bit off.
No, I'm sorry, he took 3rd. He took 3rd.
I wasn't really worried going into the contest at that point. And then the night before, I thought I was looking great. The morning of the contest, I had some kind of indigestion, stomach bloating, and I don't even know what happened. I really don't. But I could see in the mirror backstage it was starting to hold water. So at the prejudging, was definitely, you know, not only the bicep, my stomach was a bit bloated. I looked a bit watery. could have been a reaction to something I ate, or, you know.
Yeah.
In a normal day, in normal condition, with a normal person, you know, what the fuck? It doesn't make any difference in your physique in the mirror, of course. But
right. If,
like, super in shape and you're dehydrated, you just hold a little bit of water, you know.
Yeah.
Can make a difference. So, but in the night show, after all the sweating and everything like that, I was looking better. So, you know, to this day, I say the closest contest I had was the 97 with NASA.
Mm-hmm.
That was, Sean thinks 94 is close,
right.
But I don't, so.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you thought of Sean's comments after the contest, because he thought he had it.
Yeah, he still thinks that. He still, but it is what it is, man. It's like, Sean was looking good, but Dorian was like, whatever.
Yeah.
So I was 10% off. Still.
Right.
Still, you know, still a good big guy and a good little guy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not an even match, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not about that, Sean, but you were born small.
So now the next year, 95, that was kind of a redemption year for you, because you changed up your training a little bit too, right, Dorian? You changed the overhand grip on that.
Yeah, I got a deal with Hammer Strength,
okay. And
they shipped over a lot of machines from Hammer Strength from the States to my gym in UK.
Okay.
And I was using a lot more Hammer Strength for chest, to kind of work a little bit around the shoulder.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad at that point, but I knew something was going on. I used to do a lot of very heavy decline presses, up to, you know, like 500, doing like 8 reps and stuff with 500.
Wow.
And I couldn't do that anymore, so I started working on incline and the hammer bench press and flies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I was kind of compromising a little bit with what I used to do in the past because I had injuries.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, you know, I had no choice, and it was a smart thing to do. So still, you know, still training heavy like a crazy animal, but
yeah. A
bit more machine work in there and, you know, trying to avoid making this injury worse. So I really like the hammer machines for that, because I could work heavy and it was controlled. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, so 95, I think that was pretty much a slam dunk. I don't think anyone was close to you on that year. And that had to feel good coming back from the bad year in 94, right?
Yeah, the kind of redemption.
Yeah.
The bicep tear, and, you know, I mean, you know, you tear a muscle 6 weeks before a contest. You know, who knows what kind of stress that puts on your system as well, like, you know.
Yeah.
So, 95, I was good. I wasn't fighting any injuries. Training was going good. Very happy with that. Probably still say 93 was my best shape because I had no injuries and stuff. But 95 was very good, and the condition was great. And I think my back was better than it was in 93. It was more details and stuff, maybe because of doing more machine work.
Yeah.
So, I was happy with 95.
And your posing was also improved. I remember you used that routine. You sort of brought in the OJ trial because you had that Judge Ito at the beginning.
Yeah.
So your posing was more entertaining.
Yeah, it was more entertaining. I had a good guy that was putting interesting music and concepts together with me and everything. So, yeah, that was cool at the time because everyone was watching that trial on TV and stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
An attempt to be a little amusing.
Yeah. So then we go to 96, and this goes to Chicago, the Olympias in Chicago.
Yeah.
And they did diuretic testing, which was the big thing, because Nasser was originally in third, and that was his first really big year, I think, right, in 96.
Was Nasser in third or second? Yeah, he was third, yeah.
Yeah, and Sean was second, and then Nasser ended up failing the diuretic test after the contest was over, right?
Yeah, and I knew there was a diuretic test. And that's why I kind of took the decision to like come and try and come in like super shredded.
Yeah.
Because I could do that without using diuretics.
Yeah.
So I dropped down probably a little bit too much, but, you know, the details were probably more than before, but I lost a little fullness and, you know, lost a little powerful look, I guess.
Yeah.
If you see on the internet, there's a Grand Prix a week later, German Grand Prix, and I ate up a lot for that one, and that's, you know, one of my favorite conditions as well. That was very good. I was probably up like 6 to 8 pounds from the Olympia and still in the same kind of condition.
Yeah.
So, a little flat for that one, but again, you know, I think it was still a clear enough win.
Yeah. How'd you feel about Nasser? Because he came up pretty quick, and he looked fantastic from the front. Real good legs, good abs.
He looked great in 96, and some poses from the front, he definitely looked better than me. He looked really great with a relaxed from the front, because he had these real square abs and good legs. And everything. He looked very good in that pose, and in the double biceps from the front as well. He looked very good. So, for sure, he had made a couple of poses, but, you know, it's about the majority over 11 poses.
Yeah.
You know? And from the side, I still had more thickness because I got quite a lot of depth through the side from the back. And of course, from the back, Nasser was pretty weak from the back, at least in the upper body, you know? Lower body was pretty strong, but his back was weak and always a bit watery down the bottom. So, he lost out on that area.
Yeah.
But 97, it was, you know, it was much closer, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's talk about 97. That was ended up being your last year. But you had I didn't realize how bad that injury was to your tricep until I just read reread your book this week, The Warrior Story. And Peter was talking about how you tore that tricep tendon. And, man, that was an incredible thing you had to go through.
The tricep injury was far worse than the bicep injury.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the bicep injury aesthetically didn't look good, but the tendon didn't detach or anything. And actually, after about 6 weeks, wasn't a huge difference in the strength, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the tricep, I was having severe inflammation, like year round with my left elbow.
Okay.
And, really, the wise thing to have done now, looking back, would have been to take a couple of months off earlier in the year and really work on this and you know, get the scar tissue down and you know, do whatever minimal light training to get it really healthy and then start pushing again. But I don't, you know, you're Mr. Olympia 5 times and everybody's on your ass chasing you. You know, and, you know, NASA's coming up, it's getting closer, and I didn't really feel I had that time. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't my personality anyway. I just want to push all the time, you know. Yeah. And when you're young, you think you're indestructible, although at that point I was learning pretty quick that I wasn't.
Right.
So I had inflammation, tendonitis, and I had to ice it after training, was taking aspirin and all kind of stuff just to try and get through the training. Then I went to see somebody who was actually a surgeon. He worked for a soccer team in the UK. I mean, there was nobody in the UK at the time. I don't know if there is now, but nobody that's used to dealing with strength athletes and injuries and things like that. I mean, if you're a soccer player and you've got a knee injury, there's some great guys there, but that's all we had, right? So I went to see this guy, and he advised me to have a cortisone shot in the tendon, which would take the immediate inflammation down and, you know, get me through the last, I think it was about 5 weeks out that I did this, 5 or 6 weeks out. And then after the contest, he said, we'll address it. And, you know, you might have to have a little surgery to got scar tissue all around your tendon and, you know, from micro traumas over the years. And, you know, train, you need to cut back on the train a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's, how did I interpret that? Cut back on the train a little bit. Right. It's like, all right, so I'm not going to incline 440. I'll do 400 then. That's right. Like a compromise for me, you know?
Right.
So, you know, I was still training pretty heavy. And I think it was 3 weeks out. It was real near to the contest. And I was doing like an old-fashioned pullover and press with the cambered bar, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't particularly heavy. But I guess, you know, the tendon wasn't in good shape.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I know now, a cortisone injection is just going to further weaken the tissues. It's catabolic, you know? Yeah. So it takes inflammation down. You don't feel your problem anymore.
Right.
But now further weaken the structure that's already weakened, you know? Right. So it was bad advice that I got. And boom. The most intense pain and a noise that, you know, echoed around the gym. Like everyone heard it.
Wow. Bam. Wow.
And then I was like just cold shock. Physical and mental, like, not again. And, like, you know, you get a big one like that, a bicep or a tendon injury, it's not like, oh wow, how do you know? You just know that that's a fucking major injury. That's a big one, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And so it's all numb and swollen. I remember getting home and just trying to like do this, just like, you know, move it. You know, the signal from the brain was going, but it wouldn't even move.
Wow.
I think the tendon's totally come off because there's no movement there, yeah? By the next day, I could move it. what I really needed was an MRI scan, just the extent of the injury.
Yeah.
But the MRA machines we had in England were the closed ones, like a tunnel.
Yeah.
And shoulders were so big and wide, I couldn't fit in this machine.
Oh, wow.
They had no open MRIs at the time in UK, so
yeah.
I didn't know until I got to New York a week before the Olympia what was going on there exactly. And they told me it's like 95% or more of the tendon has detached. There's very little attachment to the bone, and to just be really careful. And I wasn't training at all for those last 3 weeks. I was only doing cardio and sticking to my doctor. I wasn't training, wasn't even posing, wasn't even practicing my posing the way I used to because I was scared, you know, that I could pull the tendon or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, very much less than ideal preparations for the Mr. Olympia.
Yeah. And you also you had trouble with your stomach too, right, because of all the aspirin you were taking? I totally forgot about that.
6 weeks out from the contest, I had stomach bleeding. I was hospitalized for 2 days and I had a blood transfusion.
Wow.
And, you know, of course, the doctor's asking me what stuff I'm taking, what drugs I'm taking. So I, you know, tell them all the steroids and growth hormone and some aspirin and this other anti-inflammatory that I've been getting from my doctor. So they came back the next day and they're like, right, we know what your problem is. This anti-inflammatory, I don't remember the name of it now, but this anti-inflammatory, how long have you been taking this? I said, well, like about 2 years because I get pain in my shoulder and when I stop, they get pain again. So my doctors just give me a repeat thing. I don't even go and see them. I just go and they give me the thing, you know?
Yeah.
And they're like, right, well, this is the most irritable to the stomach lining.
Oh, wow.
You should never be on this, according to this guide, never more than 3 weeks in a row. So, I mean, you know, if I was in the States, I'd probably be suing this doctor for my millions for, you know, my livelihood. But it doesn't work that way in the UK. And to be honest, I was just so focused on the contest, I didn't even think about it. I remember being in the hospital and asking the doctor, like, man, you know, when can I get out, man? I need to go to the gym. I need to train and get ready for a contest.
Yeah.
And he had to take my ex-wife aside and talk to her and say, listen, you need to speak to your husband because, you know, he's just in a life-threatening situation right now, and he's asking me when he can go to the gym. So, you know? But I was sitting there in the hospital, and she brought in my food in boxes, and I was staying on my diet, wasn't eating the hospital food, all that shit.
Wow.
And a few days later, I got out of there, and after the blood transfusion. But they were doing blood tests on me every week, getting ready for Olympia, and my hemoglobin levels were still not back to like where they should be even by the time the contest rolled around. So, you know, who knows what physical effects that have on your, you know, condition and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I had two things getting ready for that contest. And before those two things even happened, I was thinking I'm not really enjoying this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's starting to feel like a job and I never wanted to feel like that. You know, I'm going to lose my passion. I don't know how long I'm going to do, and this may be my last one. Anyway,
right.
I didn't know, but, you know, maybe that things have been different. I won it, I would have been, you know,
yeah.
I mean, another one, I don't know, but I was not, I was feeling like that. I'm not really enjoying this now, and I feel like I should be doing something else with my life.
Right.
Well, I don't know, but that was starting to have those thoughts, you know?
Yeah, and when you got to the contest, you said you were afraid to even hit that side tricep post because you thought that 10 was probably going to rip.
Somebody's going to bang. You know, on the double biceps, sometimes the elbow was banged and stuff like that. So, you know, all these things meant that mentally I was not the same person that I normally was.
Yeah.
Normally, and mentally I was just like a turbocharger, you know, like
right.
positivity that people could feel and see and you know, I was just generated because that's how I felt. But this time I felt vulnerable, I felt weak, I felt, you know, just didn't feel the same. So it was a very tough one. Yeah. And you know, Massa looked great, looked better than that in the year before, and for sure, yeah, some posters beat me on, but mathematically, I can still see how I came ahead, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So looking back over your career, Dorian, of any contest, what was the one you think you had the most satisfaction winning, whether it was an Olympia or any other one?
I got to go for 93 Olympia.
Yeah.
Although my first IFBB contest as an intermediate is also memorable.
Yeah, because first win.
Not only did I win the contest and got invited by the Federation to be in the World Games, I remember the contest promoter. There was another trophy. It was the trophy for the best physique of the day of all the contests. Yeah. So I won that, and I remember the promoter of the contest taking me on stage and saying, you know, we've had this town. It's a town with entertainment because it's by the seaside in England.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, in this town we've had a lot of famous people and this and that, and I want everybody in the audience to remember this day with this guy on stage because this guy is going to go on to be something very special.
Wow.
So I remember that, you know.
Yeah.
So that one and the 93 Olympia, because the 93 Olympia was like, you know, it was something new for the sport. It was new standards as far as conditioning combined with size and proportion and so on. So those two across my career stand out, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to ask you something because you had such a warrior mentality about, you know, getting ready for these shows and really pushing yourself to the limit. They've got Kai Greene now, and he hasn't gone to the Olympia in a couple of years, and he's been invited this year. What would you say to Kai Greene if you could give him advice? Because he's really at his peak still, and he has a chance of beating Phil Heath, but he's decided again, I think, to sit it out. What would your advice be to someone like him?
Well, I don't know why he's sitting out. He has his reasons, but I think it would be fair to say that he's the only one that could beat Phil. I don't really see anyone else that close to it. And I think I probably did say this to Kai at one time, that if he brought his body weight down and just concentrate on coming in maybe 15 pounds lighter and like super shredded, then he would have a chance of doing it. But he always tries to come in too heavy, I believe, and it doesn't, it's not to his benefit, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, why not, man? Mr. Olympia is Mr. Olympia still.
Yeah.
You know, still the number one title, and that's what history remembers, man.
Yeah, you know? I know.
If you're a bodybuilding fan, who won Mr. Olympia in this year, you know, 84, right? They're going to tell you it's Lee Haney.
Right.
The Arnold Classic in 84. I don't know.
Yeah? Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, it's still a great contest, and the prize money is the same, but the history is not the same.
Yeah.
You know, no one remembers that.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say. Mr. Olympia's history, and it would be great to get your name in the history books, but hey, he's his own man. He makes his own decisions.
Yeah, yeah. When you were competing, which guys did you think were really your biggest challenge? Or did you think you were just on your own level?
Well, physically, potentially, I respected Flex's physique, and I saw what he achieved while giving less than 100%, shall we say.
Yeah.
So I knew that, like, if he had my mentality, then I would really have a hard time, and he'd probably beat me.
Mm-hmm.
I also knew that he didn't.
Yeah.
So therefore, I wasn't really worried. Kevin was good. Kevin was great. But I just didn't feel that his physique was quite flowed like Flex's, and there was a few areas that was a bit weak. So, I didn't feel that he would be able to beat me, unless I was off, man. But I, you know. Very, very off or something, but chances of thing, you know, it only happened twice a little bit because I was injured. So in normal circumstances, it wasn't happening because I had my game plan. I knew what I was doing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. How about Sean and Lee Labrada and Nasser?
Nasser was looking very impressive in 96 and definitely got my attention.
Yeah.
Like, wow, where did that come from, you know? Because yeah. I really bored that year. And 97 as well. Yeah. 97 was, me and Nasser in 97 was the closest of all my competitions. But yeah. that, I was, you know, kind of beyond my way out anyway.
Right.
So earlier on, it would have been Kevin and Flex. And Sean, you know, Sean was... He's a great bodybuilder and always came in shape and everything. But I just felt that I would always be able to overpower him, you know? He wasn't wide enough. He wasn't big enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think you dominated in an era when it was probably the best bodybuilders of all time. I mean, the 90s is highly regarded as, you know, the greatest talent. And you won 6 straight Mr. Olympia, so that's got to feel fantastic, right?
Yeah, man. It's like, you know, you could win 20 now. And
yeah.
Probably wouldn't match that because of the depth of the quality of the guys that yeah. were there. And that time, you know, everyone was hungry and training hard and really pushing and going for it. I just don't see that spirit anymore. It seems as if the guys are not even interested in training anymore. Everyone just does the same thing and pumps up and,
yeah.
you know, no original thought out there or anything in regards to training or even nutrition. I don't see really any of the guys saying much because they all got coaches that do all that stuff for them.
Yeah, I know.
You know? So, that, you know, a lot of the stuff that I loved about the sport is not there anymore. But,
yeah.
you know, nothing stays the same forever. So, I don't sound like an old geezer saying right, things right. better in my day. You know?
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you're right on about the training, too. I mean, when you go into the gyms now, I mean, back when we were training in the 80s and 90s, it was all small, hardcore gyms, and everybody trained super hard. And now you got these bigger corporate gyms, and like you said, everybody's just maintaining. Nobody's really yeah, training that hard. Nobody's pushing themselves.
It's not an environment where hard training is even encouraged. In fact, it's actively discouraged.
Discouraged, right.
You know, you don't want to train too hard and make noise and stuff because you might scare the old lady over the other side of the gym.
Right.
Which, you know, I just think that's bullshit anyway.
Yeah.
I think everybody should be able to train in the gym together,
yeah.
whether they're an advanced professional athlete or an old retired lady.
Yeah.
Like, what's that? You're all chasing your goals. What's the problem here, you know?
Right.
I think it's just the people, the business people behind the concept
yeah.
that have got this idea. So I love, you know, anybody that goes to the gym, I have respect for them. And
yeah.
That's the way it is. Everyone should be able to train together. And there are some gyms like that, you know. Steve's gym in New York. You got all the best bodybuilders going there, football players, everything. And then,
yeah.
you know, you got your regular people who can be inspired and pick up off on the energy that
yeah.
they can get by, you know, seeing people like that training, man. Even if it's just a bit of, hey, like, you know, I feel like, look at these guys. You're going to get, you know?
Yeah.
That's what it's about. It's energy, man. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
And a good gym should have that energy. You should walk into that place and feel like you want to train. And that's what I created at Temple Gym. Like, every single person that stepped down those steps is like, first of all, there's nothing else to do down there because it's just packed with equipment. There's no space to really hang out much.
Right.
But it had that atmosphere, you know, that was what it was. It was a place where hard work was done.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why you're still so respected today, Dorian, because you really showed that warrior mentality and you trained so hard, and like I said at the beginning of the interview, you redefined bodybuilding because you brought it up another level. You had more size with that super hard conditioning that was never seen before, especially from the back, as you said. And I think that's why even today, 20 years after your career, people are still respecting you. The hardcore bodybuilders still respect you.
Yeah, I believe so. And maybe even some of the physique guys.
Yeah.
You know, listen, it's like physique guy, fucking CrossFit. I don't
right.
care, man. If you're going to the gym and you're working out,
right.
more power to you. I got respect for you, you know,
absolutely.
Whatever you're doing. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. All right, Dorian. Well, thank you very much for joining us for this interview. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. It was a great pleasure
to
talk to you.
I just want to say one thing. I just want to shout out something
mm-hmm.
I'm involved in now that's called Super League.
Oh, yeah.
Super League Live. It's not a bodybuilding contest. But it's a competition, and it's for physique athletes and powerlifters and so on.
Okay.
It's a set of exercises and a physique scan, which will take me too long to really explain. So if you go to Super League Live, it's all there. And our first contest is in July 29th. in Vegas. So okay. Going to be there, and we've got a great lineup of athletes, and I think it's something new, something exciting, and there's no judges. You know, you either lift the weight or you don't lift the weight, and yeah. The scan, physique scan has got certain ratios which you can read on the website. So, and you know, when I was competing, I always thought that's the thing that's missing. When we're on stage and people are looking, they just see the physique, but they don't see all that work that goes in there. They don't appreciate how strong and how athletic some of the guys are and so on. So now we're going to see that, and we're going to see some real freaky strong guys coming through, I think, on this. So it's, you know, it's something new for people to do.
What kind of lifts, are they going to be doing?
Sorry?
What kind of lifts are they going to be doing?
They're going to be doing 8 different exercises.
Okay.
For all different body parts, from pull downs, chest press, shoulder press, squat machine. We've had all machines because we want to keep the safety factor there, and we're not trying to compete with weightlifting or powerlifting
or
CrossFit. So they're all bodybuilding exercises on machines, and it's something, you know, if you see somebody doing one of these guys doing a pull down, you can go to the gym the next day and try and do it yourself.
Yeah.
As I said, that I think that was missing. It was like, especially for the general public, they just see this thing, this image.
Yeah.
But, you know, what does it take to get there? So now this competition kind of reveals that. And, you know, yeah. I think it's going to be exciting visually. It's going to be on live on bodybuilding.com.
Oh, really? Okay.
We've got Nike sponsoring. We've got some other people coming in to sponsor. And I think it's got real potential to take off and be international.
Okay.
So, 29th July is the first one.
What's the website again, Dorian?
Super League Live.
Super League Live, okay.
Super League Live. All the rules are on there, all the info about the contest and so on. And I'll be there and various other personalities. And look forward to seeing people there, July 29th.
Okay, well, good luck with that. I hope that takes off for you. I think that's a great idea.
All right, man. Thanks, John.
Okay, Dorian. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yes. Thanks all for having me. Good night.
All right, buddy. Take care. All right, thanks for joining us for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank TrueNutrition.com, BalanceBodyLabs.com, and Florida Alternative Medicine for their sponsorship of this special interview with 6-time Mr. Olympia Dorian Yates. It was an awesome interview. I'm glad Dorian spent some time talking to us, and I really enjoyed it. Join us next week for another special episode of the Mr. Olympia series on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We'll see you guys next week. Take care.